A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So today's interview is with Todd Minnerson. He is the executive director of the White Ribbon. It's the world's largest effort of men and boys to end men's violence against women. He's also the CEO of Parker P Consulting, and that's a social enterprise that's owned by White Ribbon. So really interesting stuff that comes out of this. So you're gonna love Todd. We talk a lot about gender and about what it means to be masculine, men's understanding of masculinity. We talk about attitudes and behaviors and about fatherhood. Both Todd and I are young fathers. We talk a lot about stereotypes and about why, you know, Todd was wearing a pink shirt for the interview. We talk about gender tests for films and this idea of calling out versus calling in. Todd talks a great deal about his mentor and the founder, Jack Layton, and who said that you got to have a dream that's going to last longer than your lifetime. Lots here for everyone. And like I say, I think you're going to enjoy Todd and what he has to say. Check them out online. White Ribbon, Todd Minnerson, the executive director, coming up shortly. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my writing and my other podcasting. And do stay tuned. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by another very special guest today, coming up on 200 interviews, I think, actually, on Face to Face. So pretty excited about that. Todd Minnerson is here with us today. He's the executive director of White Ribbon and the new CEO of Parker P Consulting, I believe. Todd, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
Yeah. So I'm going to confess right now, Todd and I do know each other. We have met. Todd has been into my class a couple of times, I think, at Humber College mm-hmm. to speak to my students. And I've just found out that they've been pestering him for the last couple of years, probably looking for work.
Looking for work and looking to change the world, which nice. Is a beautiful thing. Yeah. And you never want to see people stop having that desire
pestering
to do
small
that. Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah.
And capital P for passion.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, cool. So what is White Ribbon? How about we just start there? And let's talk about some of the thinking around it. How did it start? Your passion and so on. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, for sure. White Ribbon is a Canadian-based NGO. It started in 1991 as a result of a traumatic incident here in Canada that we call the Montreal Massacre, which many people will probably remember. For having 14 women murdered at École Polytechnique in Montreal. And a small group of guys, including the late Jack Layton, came together here in Toronto and said, you know, there has to be a role and a responsibility for men to work to end violence against women and girls. And in 1991, they came up with the symbol and the pledge we still use today, which is to never commit, condone, or remain silent about violence against women. And, you know, in 25 years, we've grown from a volunteer-driven annual awareness campaign here in Canada to a global movement of men and boys, probably the largest movement of men and boys in the world, working to end gender-based violence. with activities in over 70 countries around the world. And far from a once-a-year awareness campaign, we're doing this work, you know, 24/7, 365 days a year across a whole spectrum of different kinds of projects and interventions.
So is it about changing hearts and minds, really? I mean, obviously there's education, there's empowerment here. This is around the world too, isn't
yeah,
it? This is
yeah.
not just about in a Canadian context.
No, it's definitely around the world. It's for sure about changing hearts and minds in the way we think about changing attitudes and behaviors of men. Transitioning from a narrative that says you're just part of the problem to one that you're part of the solution. But it's also about challenging and changing the systems that perpetuate gender-based violence. So, you know, if there's two bedrocks for our work with men and boys, one is the promotion of gender equality. And if we look at, you know, issues of inequality for women and girls around the world, the experience of violence is on the tragic and traumatic end of that spectrum of inequality still. And the other kind of...
So equality is directly connected, or gender inequality is directly connected in your mind to violence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, we can look at it from two angles, that particular aspect. We can say, you know, if we look around the world where there's reduced incidences of violence against women and girls, it's places where all other gender equality indicators are really high, right? So where women are doing better economically, where they have more access to political and economic decision-making, there's less violence. It's one of the only correlations that we can find around the world. But also...
I was reading an article in the paper about a Syrian family who had come over, a refugee family, who are now, you know, obviously getting used to a whole new culture and
right.
so on and so forth. And there was a line in the article, very long, it might have been a New York Times piece, a little line about how men do things differently. And the implication was, I immediately saw the guy, some family they were visiting was washing dishes or something.
Right.
And so they're having to get used to that sort of that new culture, that gender sort of based approach.
Right,
or
right.
That hopefully is rooted in equality. I'm not always sure that it is, but...
Well, that's what we have to work towards, mm-hmm. right? And we know making the connection between inequality, whether it's lack of decision-making power or political representation, even to the kinds of language that we use sometimes, is linked directly to physical and sexual violence at the other end of that spectrum. So that's one aspect. But the main thing that we actually work on is try to work on men's own understanding of masculinity and, you know, what takes an innocent 3-4-year-old boy to an adult who may choose to use violence against women. Something happens in that time. And for us, it's these harmful and sometimes violent ideas of masculinity that can contribute to, you know, that transition for a young man to... Nobody's born a rapist, nobody's born an abuser. But there are, you know, social norms, social conditioning around masculinity that
so for you, that's clear,
move it along
right?
the way.
That it's not a genetic thing. It's not, this is something, this is nurture, this is not nature. This is, or would you say...
If we exclude, like, the psychopaths and the sociopaths
right,
of the world,
right, right,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, we know of egalitarian societies.
Donald Trump's not a part of this conversation? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I'm going to be careful about that.
right.
I lost the crowd the other day because I made a Trump joke.
Come on, seriously?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
Can you tell the joke now?
Well, no, it was off the cuff. It was nothing, but a few people afterwards said, hey, we're Trump supporters, so you lost me there.
Wow.
So very interesting.
Oh, interesting. No,
just
Canadians
keep politics
or
at it. Canadians.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, maybe once we turn the recorder off, I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are things that happen to young men, and we know there are societies around the world that don't have gender-based violence. We look at traditional indigenous cultures, for example. You know, they didn't have words for rape. They didn't have words for violence against women. They didn't have that kind of gender imbalance and that kind of harmful masculinity that contributes to it today. So we know that there are examples.
So this isn't just utopian thinking.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we know. And the evidence base around preventing gender-based violence tells us this too. We know that if men have better attitudes around equality, around respect, around consent, that they're less likely to perpetrate violence against women. So
And I'm not trying to sort of polarize the conversation because mm-hmm. it's got to be complex, right? And it's never an either or. It seems to me in development and when it comes to these kinds of issues, very systemic, very connected. Everything right matters.
Yeah.
you know, you're not going to just blame video games. You're not going to just blame film. You're not going to, you know, hold journalists responsible for what they report on, right? Is where does that kind of thinking sort of begin?
Great question.
Is it at home?
I'm going to send you an image of a slide that I use. It's an actual exercise we do in a classroom, and it was an exercise we did with some grade six boys, and we call it the man box. And so we start with a blank chalkboard, and we write the words real man on the top. And this is grade six boys, so, you know, we have kids around this age, right? They're 11, 12 years old.
Yep.
And we ask them, you know, what does it mean to you to be a real man?
What do you call it again? The real man box exercise?
Yeah, the man box exercise.
The man box exercise. Yeah. Sounds like a campaign of a sort.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, we ask them what it means to be a real man. In the space of 10 minutes, they can fill up that chalkboard. Strong, aggressive, tough, have to like sports, you're the payer, you have a bad reputation, you know.
Drinks, export ale.
Yeah, you know, all. Unfortunately, they go to a lot of the negative expectations about what it means to be a real man. That gives us an opportunity to discuss why there aren't more positive things. It gives us an opportunity to discuss, is this the narrative? Is this the story that you're told about what it means to be a man at age 11, 12 years old? But then we also ask them a couple of other questions, key questions. One is, what happens to you if you can't meet up to these expectations? And these young men are very quickly able to identify isolation, teasing, bullying, harassment. We see them identifying homophobia there, not as a tool for discrimination against gays and lesbians and transgender people, but as a tool for policing masculinity, right? So if you're not man enough, you're a wimp, you're a fag, sissy.
My son, 10, came home, used the word fag in context, what does that mean? In a conversation with me and kind of saying, Dad, what's this all about, sort of. And my response was, I smiled and I said, Spencer, I can't even believe that's still being used. I mean, that was, you know, 40 years ago when I was growing up in grade school, grade 4, 5, and 6. And we're 40 years later, and it's kind of like the old jokes, where you see your daughter playing a game on the street with her friends, and you go, oh, yeah, we used to play that, right? And you go, we haven't moved on from that?
It's a powerful tool to control masculinity, as well as a discriminatory tool against LGBT folks, right? And then on the other side of the chalkboard, we ask them, so where does this come from, guys? Mm-hmm. You're not born like this. And they, to your question, are able to say, it comes from school, media, parents, family, religion, work, economy, cartoons, violence, you know, you name it, right? So from a very early age, we're conditioning our children by gender, and they know it. That's the takeaway here. They know it and they understand it. And when we work with young men and boys to unpack and critically think about some of those things, it's amazing how they can then turn it around and say, yeah, I don't want to be part of this system, because actually now I can see not only how it harms the women and girls in my life, but also how it harms us as men and boys.
So are we talking about things like as simple as boys not being allowed to wear certain colors, play with certain toys?
Think about boys don't cry,
right?
Man up, tough man it up. Out.
And this is your earlier comment about language.
Yeah.
Deeply ideological, right? Deeply
all these influential. Things, all these things influence.
Now, Todd, isn't it?
Our boys.
It's not the one-offs either, is it? It's the cumulative nature of all this and how. So it's not just about the fact that you maybe play a violent video game necessarily, but when you combine that with all these other things connected into our culture, it starts to take a real effect.
For sure. And those cumulative effects are what we call the social norms, right? So here's an example. This cannot be attributed to one single thing, but think about the different language that we use around promiscuity, for example, right? So what do we call a young man who has lots of girlfriends? Mm-hmm. We call him a stud, a player. We celebrate it almost, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that adds to his credibility in terms of his gender identification.
It's expected. It really is expected, isn't it?
And men lie about it to make that expectation seem, you know, more credible.
Right.
What do we say about young women who have multiple partners, right? There's a very different categorization, slut, whore, negative.
Yeah, incredibly negative.
Right?
Yeah.
So neither of those things have a singular cause, but it is that cumulative effect that makes them into the powerful social norms that they are. And that then contribute to this condition where some men think it's okay to use violence against women. So we're trying to unpack, unravel, dissect, dissipate, eradicate all of that business. So, and that's the work that we're doing at White Ribbon.
Before, lots so much to talk about. But, but the violence thing really is kind of interesting to me because there are, I would imagine, hundreds of millions of men who aren't taking it to that next. So they're probably sexists, and I mean their ideas about women are flawed and so on and so forth, and yet they're not crossing that line into violence. Why not? What is it? Is it there's, you know, there's a small portion of
it's the male population? Really great question. I think there definitely are a vast majority of men who are never going to use violence.
Yeah.
There's a lesser majority of men who don't participate in sexist language or activities. There's an even lesser proportion of men who actively work to eliminate some of those things.
My father wouldn't have probably let me wear a pink shirt.
Right.
Right? But I don't think he would have ever been violent. Right? I
mean, right, right, right.
It's a bit
right,
of a leap, obviously.
Yeah.
And we're having a bit of fun here with this thought
experiment. As I sit in my pink shirt.
That's right. Yes.
For the listeners.
That's right. Excellent. Nice work.
No,
I mean... You did that on purpose.
my father would be of the same generation, right? But, for example, while my father would never have used violence ever against my mother, they have a beautiful relationship. My father would hold these kinds of beliefs. I remember this conversation distinctly with him. You know, I asked him one time when I started this work, like, he had very stereotypical assumptions about who the kinds of men were that perpetrated violence against women. And I said to him, where do you think the most dangerous place to send your daughter is? And so first he thought of a lot of local things in Toronto, like, you know, neighborhoods that don't have great reputations and things like
right.
that. Then I was like, nope, nope, nope. And then he thought about different parts of the world. And when I finally told him the answer was actually the most dangerous place to send your daughter is university.
Right.
Where she has, you know, a 1 in 4 chance of being sexually assaulted. And it must be all those immigrant, low-income, uneducated men at universities that are perpetrating this kind of violence. He was shocked, right? And it really rattled his cage around thinking about this issue. Just mostly because most men have never... We take our privilege for granted, right? And we don't really critically look at the systemic kind of fear and conditions that women have to live under. And so part of our task is unraveling all of these ideas around masculinity. Part of our task is getting men activated in the promotion of gender equality. And part of our task is raising awareness that it's still a problem and you can be part of the solution even if you're not part of the problem. And we know there's a whole bunch of good men that are stuck in a bad system. You know, a system that still perpetrates disproportionate amounts of violence against women and girls and also gives us as men and boys a lot of privilege. But if we really critically look at it, it's also costing us a lot. It's costing us in how, you know, not only just the pink shirt kind of examples, but the kinds of roles we can play, the kinds of emotional literacy we have in our lives, the kinds of relationships we can have with other men, the ability to ask for help, the unhealthy coping mechanisms that men adopt in their lives, the unhealthy risk-taking activities that men undertake in our lives. You know, all of these things are the downside of this, what we call toxic masculinity
here's
as well.
Maybe a leap, but here's the irony for me. Men want to be accepted. We all want to be accepted. We all want to be loved. We all want to be included. We all want to be embraced. Sounds like the opening line for a book. But anyway, or lines. I really, truly believe that.
Yeah.
And I think we're all struggling in one way or another to find our way back home, as crazy and corny as that may sound. And so what men are really desiring is this camaraderie and commiseration and so on, which they sort of maybe get through these more unhealthy approaches. And yet, I believe from the way I've tried to live my life in an authentic way, for the most part, with others and with other men, it actually is way more satisfying in the sense of you walk away from hanging out, playing a game of pool, or going to see a film or a great conversation going, wow, that was awesome. And you don't, it's not like you have this shock of recognition and you say, wow, that was awesome. I truly believe you're a better person for that.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where we need to get. So it's a real, it's a horrible paradox.
Yeah, totally.
Horrible paradox because it's so divisive and it's just so cliche.
You know, well, and let's go out drinking tonight and not talk about our feelings. You know, no, guys, go out drinking and talk about your feelings.
Absolutely. I mean, where are we permitted to be vulnerable with each other, right? And where are we permitted to have those kinds of conversations? We're not in a lot of spaces, mm-hmm. and so, but that's where the richness of life comes from. Real human connection comes from, right? And so many of us are told it's okay to have that in a romantic relationship, usually a heterosexual
right.
kind of relationship,
right.
and
right.
and even many of us as men work hard and, you know, have to acknowledge that probably our partners do a lot of the emotional labor in
right.
relationships
right.
To do that. The other place we're allowed to do it is with our kids.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And, you know, for us, fatherhood is a great entry point for talking to men about new ideas of masculinity. I mean, we've both talked about our fathers, and I'm suspecting that we both had, you know, pretty easygoing upbringings and pretty comfortable upbringings with them. But I don't know a person my age in their 40s, for example, who has kids under the age of 15 who doesn't want to do fathering differently than their father did it, no matter how great their relationship
was
with their dad.
Which has got to be a pretty great sign to an organization like yours.
That is where we see hope and an entry point and a place for change. You know, if there's a guy out there who has a daughter and a son, and the daughter says, "I want to play hockey," I don't know a guy now who's not going to say, "Oh, hockey's not for girls."
Right.
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 This is the tip of the edge of social change around gender equality. Right. This guy may not realize exactly yet that he's a champion for gender equality just by doing what seems natural
exactly.
for his daughter. But we're trying to help men understand that, that's the start. Now let's like really figure out how you can do that.
Can you sit through a family Christmas dinner and somebody says something that's a little troubling to you from a gender perspective and let it go and let it slide?
My family is on point now. This 10 years in this work, they're all good. But I could tell you a funny story of when I first started this work. You know, I referenced the pledge earlier on to never commit, condone, or remain silent about violence against women, right? I took this job and I just started playing hockey again with some of my university friends.
Mm-hmm.
After kind of 10 or 11 years of not really hanging out very closely with them, we decided to form this hockey team. And it was early days. And so I still felt like my position in this group was vulnerable and I may not be able to stick with the team and all this kind of stuff. And I'm doing up my skates one day in the dressing room and somebody made a pretty awful rape joke.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, I felt this rush of redness from my toes, up my legs, out the follicles of my hair. I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? I just took this job, this pledge. I can't be silent. I don't get kicked off this team. They're going to hate me. I'm never going to play again. I suck at hockey anyway. Like all this stuff was going through my head in a millisecond. And I thought down, I said something eloquent like, you know, and I kept my head really low when I said this. I said, "That's not funny." I was as eloquent as I could get up.
You were untying your skates at
yeah,
this point.
Yeah, I kept the head low down by the skates so they wouldn't
really
even be sure
funny.
Where it's coming from. And it was, "That's not funny." And the joke stopped. It was fine. I still play hockey with them 10 years later. But the interesting thing happened after we got out of the dressing room and we're walking through the parking lot. Two other guys came up to me and said, "I'm glad you said something." I didn't know what to say. It was a crappy joke. Made me feel uncomfortable, but thanks for saying something, right? So I think, you know, and to this point earlier about the quote-unquote good guys that are out there, I think there's a lot out there. I think they don't know what to do. I think they've never had those kinds of role models. I think there's a fear of getting it wrong. I think there's a sense amongst some men that gender still isn't really an issue that men should be leading on, but women should be, even in a benevolent way. Like it's not my role, it's not my obligation.
Right.
Necessarily in like it's women's work. You know, even in a benevolent way to say I don't feel comfortable taking a lead here. But what we've got to have men understand that gender is dynamic, it's relational. It's not just about women, it's not just about men. It's about the relation we have between each other, and moving it more towards equality means as men we've got to step up and make that comment in the dressing room and be a part of that change. And I guarantee you it's hard, but the first time is the hardest.
yeah, for sure.
And you'll always find other guys that are appreciative of it.
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the point I was trying to make earlier, but we all truly just want to be included.
Yeah.
And so I think there is a fear there. And so when somebody speaks up. There's almost a fellowship of a sort. Because I've been in situations like that where people have said after a talk, or, wow, I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
So glad. And I know there are lots of us around where things like that have happened. Teachers that we've had in the past, you know, a public speaker who says something that, you know, that really needed to be said, that spoke about that elephant in the room or that untruth, right?
To those school kids too, right? They identify what happens to you if you can't fit into this dominant narrative of masculinity. They can identify where it comes from, but we haven't done a great job is giving them a new place to coalesce around.
Right, right.
Right, a new place to feel part of a community. And like that father who promotes his daughter playing hockey, the guys in my dressing room, the people that come up after a talk and hear these things, they're craving that. They want that. They at a certain level know what harm these stereotypical ideas of masculinity are costing all of us. But we haven't done a great job of creating that alternative out there in the world.
Where does Hollywood fit into this for you? And Hollywood is like, just means media, basically, doesn't it? I think they sometimes take unfair criticism.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they are, you know, the purveyors of ideas and ways of seeing.
It's a great question. It's like that, you know, it's like your earlier point. It's easy to identify those singular incidences, like the musician who's been charged with abusing his partner or something, or the really misogynist lyrics or the awful movies, but it's really that cumulative effect again, right? Mm-hmm. Of everything that's out there. And there's this double whammy of so much of our socialization comes from popular media, and B, so much of it is based on kind of crass capitalism.
Yes.
That we've lost what used to be the purpose of art and literature and music, which was to kind of get to some of those complex things, and it's really been dumbed down to like what's going to sell the most Pepsi, right?
Well, it's been dumbed down to lifestyle advertising, sadly.
Exactly.
Right? And the lines have been crossed in so many ways, right? And art is about mystery and imagination, not about selling goods.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, so this is a big problem, and you can't turn that around individually either. But what we like to do is look for ways, first of all, to be critically analytical about it. So, you know, one great example is in film, there's a mechanism called the Bechdel test. Have you heard of this?
I don't think so. No.
It's a way to understand kind of gender roles
How
in
do you
movies.
Bechdel.
And it's a way, like, I don't remember it exactly, so bear with me, but it's like, how many female characters are there? How many conversations amongst female characters only?
Right,
what kinds of roles did they play? And there's about four things you can measure, right, in a film. And does it pass the Bechdel test or not, right? Is it just this token, you know, insertion of women into it?
Let me guess, the Fast and Furious films do not pass this test.
Well, unfortunately, most movies, even some that we think are quite progressive, don't actually pass it, and the bar is not very high, right? It's not exactly a really excruciating test to pass.
And the idea is not to reduce something so complex and so nuanced and relational to numbers, but the idea is to say, here's at least a way to say, okay, we're not even coming close.
Right, and let's look at some of our unconscious bias around these things, right? We think we're doing an equitable job, but if we actually break it down on these four factors, it's not close,
right?
The other thing that we look for, in addition to these ideas to kind of be more critically aware of media, is these amazing examples of artists who already are. So everybody in Canada would know A Tribe Called Red, right? This amazing indigenous electronic hip-hop band, right? They're unbelievable in the things that they do in terms of merging new creative, bold music with really traditional sounds and stories and songs and meaningful, deep kind of stuff. So there's the one of the main guys is called DJ Indian. He's also a DJ in clubs around the world. And just about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, he said, I'm going to make a conscious effort to not play any music from this point on that has misogynist lyrics or content in it. So he is showing the way to be more critically aware of these things and to put it into action.
You know, people, hey, listen, I'm a huge U2 fan. In fact, interviewed somebody yesterday who's writing a book about U2, and their mediated brand is the subtitle. So I had a great time on this interview yesterday. But people like Bono, and folks that are speaking out, they take a lot of criticism for some of those things sometimes because of the inconsistencies and the paradoxes that seem to exist maybe in their life. But at the same time, they are, I think, shifting the conversation, right? And they've got a platform. And so this DJ has this opportunity, right, to speak new language into
yeah.
it and to show that there is maybe a better way, right, to do what he does.
Whenever you put yourself out there, you're going to be a lightning rod. Because there is still so much resistance and opposition to some of these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, as people that are interested in this kind of work, whether it be human rights or social justice or unpacking privilege or anything, we always have to be open to feedback and critique.
Yeah.
You know, we're never done learning and growing.
Well, that's, I think, the thing that, for me, is so important. Change has got to be incremental. It's got to be splash and ripple, but you got to be open, and the hope's got to be at the core and at the center. And if you lose that, you're probably not going to be believing in too much social change.
No,
that's going to be coming, right?
No way.
Yeah. I was listening to somebody recently talking about falling forward. I thought it was, it's a phrase I've heard before, but it hit me in a new way.
Right.
It's great. You're taking risks. You're making mistakes, but you're gonna keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Right. You're stepping ahead.
We also. You know, people are probably familiar with calling out stuff, right?
Yes.
Calling out racist comments or sexist
yeah,
comments.
Kind of what you did when you were tying your skates.
Right, except, you know, I could have been a bit more bold about it.
<That's right. laughs>
We also embrace this idea of now calling in, right?
Mm.
So, hey, I heard you made that joke in the locker room. I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what exactly you think is funny about it and if you're aware of the kinds of hurt that it might be causing people and the kinds of stereotypes it might perpetuate,
redefining
right?
Redefining shame.
Well, it's not just shame. It's
yeah.
like, I know this guy and I know his family and I know he's a good dad and I know he's not likely to ever use violence, but could he connect the dots between that man-up culture and just making that joke in a locker room to those things?
And what's interesting about that is there are comics who might use a joke like that from the stage, might get criticized for it, but would then argue in an interview, well, hang on, I'm calling this out.
Yeah.
That's what I'm actually trying to do by saying, right? So it's a bit of a weird one, but I'm not suggesting for a second that that's happening in most locker rooms
or yeah.
in most bars on a late
but yeah, no, but
Friday
this,
night.
Like, but calling in is another way to kind of say to people, like, tell me what you think is funny about
yeah,
that. Like,
good.
I don't find it funny and I'm trying to figure out why.
Yeah. Yeah,
you
well,
do.
That's about conversation, about dialogue, and about being, I hope, transparent and authentic.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Which is what you guys are really all about. So tell me more about White Ribbon and Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, and you've got a new consulting social enterprise you're working on. I mean, things seem, I mean, are going pretty well around here.
We're busy.
Where are the White Ribbons, by the way? I'm sitting in the boardroom, and there are no damn White Ribbons. What's
There's a high-heeled shoe over there, and
oh,
we'll get you one. We'll get you one on your way out.
Maybe we should get a photo of you with the shoes on.
Sure.
I'm sure you have a few.
I do. I have my son says in the car, Daddy, are those your work shoes? And I'm like, yes, they are, son. Yes, they are. You know, things are great at White Ribbon. We're very busy. It's a combination of, 25 years of hard work and also the changing times we're in. You know, you can't open the news these days without a new and different incident of, unfortunately, violence against women and high-profile ones at that over the last little while. But in a way, as sad as it is that it takes those high-profile incidents, the conversations are changing, right? And the tone is changing, and the impetus to do things has changed. So, we run about five or six project-specific initiatives here funded from different levels of government on sexual violence prevention and working with the education sector, and a project called It Starts With You, It Stays With Him, which was about how men can play an active role in the lives of young men around promoting gender equality and respect. But we're also doing some work around growing and strengthening the evidence base for prevention work with men and boys.
Mm.
So we're working on a national community of practice with about 9 organizations across Canada, developing tools and toolkits for best practices and communities that want to do this work. We're also increasingly trying to engage non-traditional partners in this change. And so we've been working with the private sector in a number of spaces. We've been working with a mining company for the last 4 years around how to develop community-based, gender-based violence prevention responses in those communities where they work. And those were three-year projects in Papua New Guinea, Nevada, and Zambia that showed great potential, not only for how a company can invest in prevention in those communities, but how it can really make a difference in a way that no other institution could intervene in those places.
And a lot of people believe that development really, you know, the future of development is going to have to be about that coming together, that ecology of commerce, which I often talk about, Paul Hawkins' phrase, the coming together of that sort of development and aid sector with the corporate capitalist sector that says we can kind of do this together by changing the tone of the conversation and doing things just a little bit differently.
Not only do it together, but help private sector come to the space where they understand that it's part of their social license to operate.
Well, why can't it be best practice?
Where it's good business.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the thing that moves the decision makers in those spaces. But, you know, the saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, you know, companies are learning the hard way. If they don't do meaningful work around issues like gender-based violence, when they do have an incident, it costs is not only financial but reputational,
and so on. Well, and huge
community.
Social implications. Like I'd like to think our kids are not going to want to work for that company.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that is coming.
Retention and recruitment of staff, employment, employee engagement, and happiness. All of those things increasingly add to that business case for doing this kind of stuff and doing it right. Not moving beyond the PR campaign and into meaningful partnership development work and policy level change. And so to that end, we've just launched a for-profit social enterprise wholly owned by White Ribbon called Parker P Consulting. And we're working with private sector, with post-secondary institutions, with legacy institutions like the armed forces and police forces to look at really how to do deep culture change around gender equality and engaging men and making their workplaces not only safer for women, but more inclusive and more equitable and better for men as well.
It's I love the fact that you guys are growing. I love the fact that there seems to be an ethos of hope.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, you're smiling. You know, like what is it that gets you out of bed in the morning? And I think I sort of know the answer to that, but I guess maybe the other side of that coin, and I don't really believe in the two-sided coin metaphor, by the way, but what is it that you see as a wedge, other than, I guess, culture and the violence itself, what's getting in the way of getting this work done? And I think the follow-up is, are you out of a job one day?
Well, you know, we joke around here. That's our mission, is to put ourselves out of work. We also, you know, from my mentor, Jack Layton, and, you know, one of the last conversations I had with him before he died, I was expressing my frustration with him, like, Jack, it's just such a huge job. How are we ever going to get there? And he said to me, you know, you've got to have a dream that's going to last longer than your lifetime, or else you're not working on the really important issues. So, you know, unfortunately, this may last longer than my lifetime. I'll be very happy to put myself out of work in this line of work anytime in the near future. And the progress, the partnerships, the willingness to do the meaningful work is what gets me out of bed in the morning. The barriers, the wedges, the things that are still in the way, you know, unfortunately, there's still a lot of lack of awareness around the issue of violence against women, the scope. A lot of people feel like, oh, we're done with that. Like, we don't have that issue here anymore, right? Like,
right, we've solved that
problem.
Yeah,
like, this is still a problem?
Right.
Not for me. The other kinds of barriers, challenges, are helping men see the role they can play, helping change this dynamic from one of apathy or othering the situation to, you know, it's not me, it's those guys, go talk to them, to it may be those guys, but I can help change things. And you know, we constantly struggle with how to get men activated on this. There's a long list of things that get in the way of that, you know, lack of involvement or mobilization or you know, community work for men in general, challenging our own privilege, the lack of role models in it. So that for us is really one of the hugest barriers. But the hope comes from working with these young guys who are doing the chalkboard exercise,
right,
you know.
Right.
They get it. And once you help them see
the
world that way, they don't go back. They
the
can't
aha
look back.
Moments, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the stuff that gets you going. I remember having an professor at York, mass media and ideology. He looked like Karl Marx. And I remember asking him after a class once, you know, it seems like you've got a very, I don't know, disinterested bunch in the class. And I was riveted. 3-hour lectures, just nonstop. Probably too much for most, but I loved it. I ate it up. And he said, listen, if I get through to a couple people in a class, that's, I've learned, it's taken me years to learn that you land a couple.
Right.
Right. You connect with a couple and you've kind of done your job. And it's a hard lesson, I think, right? Because I don't know about you, but I want to change the world. But I'm, you know, even, you know, as lofty and crazy and moronic almost in some respects that is, you realize that it is the little things, man. It's the taking time with your kids. It's reflecting. It's shaking a hand well.
Yeah.
It's making eye contact, smiling. I mean, simple, silly.
Speaking up in that locker room.
Exactly. Right. That is going to change the world. And you gotta believe. I love Leighton's comment.
Yeah.
You gotta have a dream that's gonna last long. Otherwise, and that's all hope driven, right?
Yeah.
So we need to wrap it up, sadly, and we're gonna have to do a part two. I'm getting a T-shirt made up, by the way, that says we're gonna have to do a part two. Because
continued.
I don't like ending these conversations. I hate it, but we've got to shut it down somewhere. The GO train ride is only so long, right? The most important question, though, I've been dying to ask you is, what color of high heels do you prefer to wear?
Oh well, see, I have two.
Okay.
I have the bright red 6-inch stilettos for our Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, and I use those for all my media engagements. It's kind of with our logo and such.
But you have calluses on your feet.
Well, no, but I've gotten wise. My actual walk day boots are a pair of knee-high silver glam boots. Think Bowie 74.
Funny.
And
Kiss, maybe?
They have maybe some Kiss, maybe some Paul Stanley
in
there. But they have a nice wide heel and a nice wide toe, so I can actually wear them the whole day and run around and do my thing at our event.
And real quick, this is a fundraising event you guys do annually
That's right.
Picked
yeah,
a lot of
it's our biggest fundraising and awareness event. We hold it in May every year, and we had 700 plus guys walking through downtown Toronto in high heels to raise awareness for ending violence against women.
I want to see the video on that.
So that gives me hope too.
Yeah, I bet it does. Todd Minterson, he's the executive director of White Ribbon. Check them out online, whiteribbon.ca.
That's correct. Yeah,
and you'll learn more there. Thanks a lot, Todd, for your candor and your insight. Really.
Thanks, David.
It.
Yeah, congrats on 200 interviews, and look forward to part two.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.